What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. I'm your host, Katie Helper. Monday, March 29th is the deadline for mail-in ballots for almost 6,000 Amazon workers in Bessemer, Alabama, who are voting on whether to form the company's first union. The workers there make an average of $15.30 an hour. Over 80% of them are Black and the majority of them are women. And just a reminder that Amazon CEO and founder Jeff Bezos is the richest person in the world. During the pandemic, his fortune rose by $75 billion. So to talk about this unionization effort, I speak to Chris Smalls, a former Amazon worker, and Alex Press, a labor reporter. Chris Smalls worked for Amazon for 5 years, but was fired shortly after he helped organize a work stoppage at the company's warehouse on Staten Island, New York, in protest over a lack of protective gear and hazard pay for employees. He's since become an organizer and founded the Coalition of Essential Workers. Alex Press is a staff writer at Jacobin, and her writing has appeared in places like Washington Post, The New Republic, The Nation, N Plus One, and more. My co-host on this episode is Jamie Peck, who is the co-host herself of the Antifada podcast. Please rate and review the show on iTunes, and also please subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. For $5 a month, you get bonus episodes, extended interviews. This week, you'll be getting an interview that I did with Karina Moreno about Biden's immigration policies and some less serious chats, like debates about cheese, that I have with Karina and Rania Kallik. I'm going to start out with asking Chris, what your view of what is happening is right now in Bessemer, Alabama.
I hope, once again, that we're successful. We had a very good campaign, as you've seen. Bernie Sanders was just down there, Killer Mike. A lot of prominent people showed up down there. Sarah Nelson, who I will be actually interviewing tonight. That's why I have to run.
Oh, great. Well, thank you for making time for us.
Yeah. She'll be joining It's a Smalls World, my podcast. So we're going to be talking about that same exact thing, the union drive tomorrow, that's going to be ending. And I'm just happy to show my solidarity. I've been doing a bunch of appearances at the rallies here in New York. And we have actually one more coming up on Tuesday, which will be after the vote. But we're hoping to have the results back in and we'll have some positive news to share with the former facility that I worked at. That's where the rally will be at. So it's a great week coming up. And it's great things in the media right now about the working class. This union drive is probably the most important of all. So I'm just happy to be a part of it.
Alex, do you want to just set up from the reporting you've done, like what's happening here, the significance of it?
Yeah, I mean, what Chris said is definitely true at the end there, that this is a really important union drive. I mean, people sort of always say every union election is important, but not only is this like a lot of workers, so it's almost 6,000 workers that'll be in this union should they vote to unionize, but also it's sort of this like turning point in that Amazon is so anti-union and is so sort of the leading model of what the economy is going to look like, that it represents a sort of similar thing to when auto plants were first organized. You know, if there were a victory at this Amazon plant or at this warehouse, it would be a sort of similar thing. You know, that said, I think whether they win or lose, we've already seen that it's sort of inspiring similar activity around the country, not only at Amazon, but also at other companies, because the sort of thinking is if people can get to this point in an Alabama Amazon warehouse, then, you know, any workers anywhere should try to organize. And so that's sort of the context of what's happening. Obviously, there's the fact that it's a right to work state, incredibly, sort of hard to organize context. All of that is really important too. But I think, you know, what Chris said of like the coverage of this, I think is really important. All of a sudden there's sort of a way more critical conversation about sort of what workers have the right to demand on the job. And I think you can point to this campaign as sort of responsible for that.
Yeah. So this campaign is going on under the banner of the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, the RWDSU. I was just wondering if you guys had any insight into why the workers went with that union and maybe some of the pros and cons of going with a more traditional kind of what some might say is a business union over what might be considered more radical and autonomous forms of labor organizing.
Yeah, so from my experience when I drove down there and I connected with the union, the leaders and some of the workers as well, and some of the union reps, and the poultry factories are what that union predominantly represents. And those factories are down there sprinkled out throughout Alabama, some of them about even an hour or 2 hours away from Bessemer. And those union reps came down there to organize with the RWDSU, which is based out of Birmingham. They have their office over there. So this union down there represents a lot of the workers, essentially majority of the black and brown communities. A lot of those workers already were embedded with the RWDSU. And when Amazon opened up shop last year, around March, it was a perfect opportunity for them to jump all over unionizing, which they actually got a head start on and did successfully. So the RWDSU represents what the workers want at that time. And, you know, that's the beauty of working, working for this company, because at the same time, you can have a different union in every single facility, and whichever union represents the working class or the workers of that building the best, it's the one that you want to go with. So I'm happy that the workers actually chose to pick that union, and the union actually supported them all the way through.
You've been down there, Chris, right? Can you talk about what you've seen down there and how it compares to what you went through up north?
Well, I could tell you this. When I looked at that facility, it's exact same size and the amount of workers, even though they're at 6,000. We're the same thing up here in Staten Island, about 5,000, probably a little bit more now with the hiring that they have been doing. So I look at that building. Same size, almost 14 NFL football fields, over 1 million square feet. The similarities are there. The majority of black and brown workers that is representing. That's what really resonated with me when I connected with the workers down there. The fact that I'm able to tell my story, and a lot of them didn't even know who I was. And we were able to have those real conversations of why I drove 16 hours down there and the importance of them voting yes. So that stuff like that, what happened to me and others don't happen to them and don't happen anymore. You know, we want to be protected. We want to demand to have PPE. We want to have all these negotiations and contracts. We need a union to absolutely represent us. So I think those conversations really, really resonated with the workers.
So you've referenced a few times how the majority of the workers in this shop are black and brown. How do you see this union drive intersecting with the fight for racial justice? And do you think it's been mediated at all by the George Floyd rebellion of last summer?
So, you know, from my own personal experience with Amazon, they have a very deep systemic issue as well, and culture as well. I myself applied for management position 49 times and I was denied. And as you look at their numbers, which are publicly, you know, shown, only 8% of upper management is black and brown. And then we're talking about over 1.5 million employees worldwide. So as you move up the ladder, the less diverse it is in that company. And after 26 years of existence, there's something wrong there. So I believe that this union drive will also be the tipping point for when management can now give an equal employment opportunity to workers, especially black and brown workers of these warehouses. So when it's time for these promotions, we have a fair share and we have a fair shot of getting promoted up instead of them predominantly picking people that are, you know, just white or Caucasian. So I'm hoping that this breaks barriers in many different ways. But the first thing would be to unionize.
Yeah. And I'll just add on that the context here, you know, if you sort of start reading about or talking to some of the workers in the Bessemer facility who sort of got this union drive started, they were very active in, for example, the protests against Confederate monuments in Alabama. And they explicitly cite those protests and also the just more general protests over the summer that followed from George Floyd's murder as what gave them the confidence to start organizing their facility. So it's not anyone outside of the campaign who's sort of drawing those conclusions. I've written about it extensively. It's actually those that starts from what the workers themselves are saying here, which I think is an important point for people way beyond just this campaign to think about, which is that, you know, I write about the labor movement. That's what I do all the time. And people sort of treat that as separate from, say, those protests over the summer for racial justice. But the fact is that the people at those protests go back into the workplace. And so these things are incredibly linked and you can't really separate them. And I think this is a really good example, a pretty high profile example of that being the case. But it's true at a smaller scale or, you know, outside of the headlines at all sorts of workplaces across the country right now, that people who sort of feel newly empowered because they were a part of those protests are trying to do something in their workplaces as well. And so I think it's something everybody on the left should sort of take note of in that sense. And I mean, yeah, the fact that Bessemer has a very radical history when it comes to anti-racist labor movement activity, that's also the case. There was a sort of black-led civil rights tradition union called the Mine Mill Union that, you know, helped make a place like Bessemer a real like heart of the labor movement, decades ago. And so those are people's grandparents who are explicitly informing this sort of perspective that people are taking.
And can you share, Chris, what some of the things that you experienced that Amazon subjected you to, what made you organize a walkout and what the experiences are like of the people in Bessemer?
So, yeah, it's funny, ironically, I've been sharing all week, sort of like a recap of what I went through last year, just going back into that mind state leading up to the walkout. I sat in the cafeteria for 10 hours a day off the clock, unpaid, not just myself, but with several workers. Unfortunately, none of them were paid. And I organized that because I thought that management had my back. They actually were praising me for doing that. They gaslighted me into thinking I'm doing something, organizing workers until they decided to quarantine me and only me. And that's when I felt like, wow, this is it. You know, I can't work for a company that's not going to care about our concerns when especially we're talking about, you know, I brought a majority of black and brown and women. We're talking about women as well that were having some were pregnant. Some had infants at home. Some had underlying health conditions, and they disregarded all of that to quarantine me and silence me and stop us from organizing when we're really, it was a life or death situation at that time. So when I think about this union drive, you know, if we had a union to represent us, none of those things would have happened. You know, we would have had the proper PPE, we would have had the proper right to hear our grievances out and had the right to actually organize without retaliation, and I probably would still have a job. Actually, I'm definitely would have a job if I had a union to represent me. And that's the difference. And that's the importance of why my story and my journey that, you know, throughout the year is so important to this fight. as well, because I continue to organize and support workers all around the country, if not all around the world. So I'm hoping once again that, you know, tomorrow when the vote closed, that it's a landslide and it's on our behalf, because it's time.
Were there any horror stories that you heard about from Bessemer that were, this is probably a bit stereotypical, but I, of course, assume, not that I think it's rosy, you know, on Staten Island in many ways, but in the Northeast, right? But of course, things are in the South can be much more brutal when it comes to workers' conditions, and it's a right to work state. So have you seen a difference, heard a difference in the stories that you've heard about? Or are the similarities more striking than the differences?
No. Well, there's similar things, but I could tell you from what they experienced and what I experienced as well when I was down there. So I stood out there for hours with the organizers or without them, holding signs. And, you know, some of the stories they were telling me was that management will come out. We'll talk about managers of Amazon will come out and flip the bird to them, you know, call them racial slurs, N-words. There's a police present at every entrance. It's true about the traffic lights. They do change automatically as soon as your car pull up. So the organizers don't even have a chance to talk to these workers anymore. And I ran into some workers at a local grocery store, and they told me they were subjected to four classes a day. They go into class four times a day, these classrooms. They're broken down into small groups of 20, and they're just drilled nothing but non-facts about unions all day long. And I couldn't imagine doing that. And I don't know if you've seen the report about how they're offering, I believe it's $2,000 for them to resign now and then rehired after the union vote process. This is something this company has never done before. Usually when it comes to that offer, when you take that offer, you can't work for Amazon or any of its subsidiaries ever again. So they're doing some things that are just above and beyond. They're spending millions of dollars to bust this union drive up. And it's a shame, it's unfortunate that the richest, you know, man in the world continues to do this.
That's how pro-worker they are. They don't want workers to be fired permanently, so they're willing to rehire them. If you want to resign, so you're not part of the union count, for instance. Yeah, that's their, I'm sure that's their how they'd spin it. And as MCVS points out, workers may vote no in fear of retaliation. Have you seen that? Have you heard that fear expressed or people's reluctance? And if people do think that, they may not say it. What advice do you have for them?
It's a lot of misinformation. The Amazon is telling them that they're going to lose hundreds of dollars as soon as they sign up with this union, that they're going to go on an immediate strike for months and lose out on months of pay. They're going to pay $500 up front, not really explaining that that $500 is really for the annual cost of a union. And as far as me telling them about what happened to me or other workers reaching out to these workers down there in Bessemer saying what happened to them, those are the stories that really resonate, is because they want to understand, like, why do we need to vote yes for this union? And I believe that when we connected with them and we told them, like, hey, I was a picker, I was a packer, I was a stower for 10, 11, 12 hours. I was in the same position you was for 4 years, for 5 years. Those stories right there really connected with them. And not only did I got the feedback from workers saying that they're going to vote yes because of that, they're going to tell their coworkers, they're going to tell the people on their assembly line to vote yes as well. So it was really helpful, actually.
Jamie, do you have a question? Or if I have more.
Sure. Is it my turn?
Alex, if you have any questions as a journalist, of course.
I just want to say hi, Alex. I mean, I always talk to Alex. This is the first time I've seen on the visual.
I know. It's good to get a visual of you. I haven't actually, we haven't met. So this is a nice homecoming. I mean, it's funny seeing you when they mentioned that you're going to be on the show. I was like, God, what a long year for you. It's been a long year for all of us, but my God, it's crazy for you.
Yeah.
So no, I don't have any questions for Chris. I mean, I'm just happy that he's still fighting the fight and that he's, involved in this, in supporting the workers in Bessemer. Yeah. Because that's the thing is, for better or worse, and it's probably for worse, you can't organize just one Amazon facility. You just can't. Even if these Bessemer workers vote in the union, the first thing that Amazon's going to do is start trying to make their facility redundant. And so connections across Amazon facilities, win or lose this vote, are going to be key to actually building worker power And so efforts like what Chris is doing, I think, are really important. That's
super important. I was going to ask, what kind of support have the workers at this facility seen from the organized left so far, whether we're talking about DSA or other organizations? And what do you think the role of the organized left should be in supporting this kind of union activity?
Well, for one, I like that the politicians went down there, and that's cool and all, you know, but we also got to think, you know, what workers do on a normal day-to-day basis. And a lot of workers don't come home and turn on the media, and they don't turn on social media or get on Twitter like we do, or, you know, jump on podcasts. They don't do that. You know, I can tell you personally, when I got off of work at Amazon, I was going to sleep to get ready for the next day, which was literally like a power nap. So what can we do on the outside besides pray? We just have to support it any way possible. If you are in Bessemer, if you're on the ground, if you're connecting with workers in any way, shape or form, that's what you have to do. Support them until this vote is all the way through. And that's it. You know, hope for the best, because, you know, at the end of the day, these workers are being torn. You know, they're being torn when they go to work. They got their management all day long. Union busters Amazon hired that they're paying $3,200 a day on top of them. And they're getting all these incentives right now. They're getting all these tools to go anti-union, brainwashed, so to speak. They're being brainwashed as they go in that building. I can tell you that. And when they come out of there, you know, they're met with union reps on the corner, and then they're met with signs and everything all around their city. So they're being torn. And we just have to make sure that, you know, we support them and let them know, show them our solidarity, whether it's online, whether it's on the ground. These events that we're doing nationwide has been helpful and insightful. I'm starting to see workers from that building tweet at me now. So it's great to make these connections. Slowly but surely is working.
Yeah, I mean, my opinion on this is that it is the role of the organized left to be there as much as possible. So whether you're talking about DSA, which, you know, to my understanding, has been incredibly present, both locally and also national leadership of DSA has, you know, have been in Bessemer supporting the workers. But, you know, beyond that, but beyond organizations sort of supporting workers, trying to organize and doing what they can to build that effort. You know, a lot of people ask me all the time, not just about Amazon, about all sorts of union campaigns, like, what can I do to help? You write about a workplace issue and people say, what can I do to help? And the answer is generally that you should either organize a union at your workplace or start strengthening existing unions that you're in or the labor movement in your city. Because, you know, you can't do a lot of people, I think, wish they could just donate or something, you know, that you could just sort of do one thing really quickly and it makes, you know, and it helps the workers. The reality is that we all have to get organized. There's just no way that even an organized, you know, Amazon, that those workers could keep those unions, that they could win strong contracts without rebuilding the labor movement writ large. And so sadly, the answer is that it's not going to be one thing that you do one time, but you actually have to start strengthening labor where you are as well. And that will actually help the workers elsewhere, even if it doesn't seem so obvious right away.
Well, speaking of have to organize, I know someone has to leave the chat right now because he's doing so much organizing. And right now, I believe you said you're going to be interviewing Sarah Nelson. So thank you so much, Chris, for coming. Alex, we're going to hold you hostage for a little bit longer, if that's okay.
That
and
is
any
fine.
Final words that you have, Chris, for anyone out there?
Yes. You know, just say to stay tuned. Support the union drive. Last day tomorrow. Workers get their ballots in. Hopefully they already did already. Vote yes. And follow my show as well. It's a Smalls World. My campaign is starting actually on Tuesday, March 30th. I'll be rallying outside of Staten Island, my former facility, JFK 8, at 11 a.m. If you're in the New York area, come out, show out. It's going to be a huge turnout. Stand in solidarity with the workers. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much, Chris.
Great seeing you,
Chris. Have a great night.
You too. Take care.
Thanks.
We as socialists don't just want workers to get a better pay and better benefits, better conditions, et cetera, et cetera. We want workers to take over the means of production and run it themselves, because people have the people making this stuff, we believe, have the right to control how the stuff gets made and, you know, control over their time and their creative powers. So how might a union campaign like this one fit into the broader fight against capitalism and for socialism?
That's a great question, Jamie. And that's a gigantic question as well, obviously. I mean, the reality is, so, you know, the thing with a union campaign is that, you know, unions are not revolutionary organizations, but they're insufficient, of course, for, you know, if you want to take away Amazon from the bosses and put the infrastructure in the hands of workers, you're not going to do it just with the union, but you're not going to do it without organized workers. And a union is just what we call it when workers are organizing. And so, you know, as it exists currently, we're living, you know, at the whims of people like Jeff Bezos and people like the workers in the Bessemer facility have no say at all in what they're subjected to, which is why you hear all these horror stories about these jobs, especially at Amazon. And so, you know, a union is a step along the way, right? Because if workers are disorganized like they currently are in the United States, and more so than ever after this pandemic, people are more alienated than ever. They're suffering more than they have in a very long time, at least a lot of people. You're never going to get anywhere with that kind of disorganization and alienation. And so workers coming together and actually exercising, you know, the small number of legal rights that they have in this country is the first step along the way of actually them getting empowered enough to do something more. So if you want to demand that, say, you know, the workers seize the warehouses, well, you're never going to do that if the workers can't even speak up and speak back to their managers, right? Without fear of being retaliated against. So if you don't have things like just cause, if you don't have things like protection against discriminations, if you don't have things like a livable wage, no one is going to have time to do anything further, you know, because as Chris said, everybody's too busy trying to get enough rest to go back to work the next day. And so these efforts, I think, are incredibly important. And like I said earlier, you know, you can't do it in one warehouse. That's just never going to be sustainable, even if you can win a union or win a contract even in that warehouse. Amazon is incredibly powerful and they build in redundancy and turnover is incredibly high. And so, you know, these efforts, as they spur other efforts elsewhere and they start building kind of networks of organization among workers, that's sort of the blueprint and the early markers of what actual worker power looks like. That's my opinion at the very least.
And that we can also get into those bigger philosophical questions, but let's also wanted to ask you some of the particulars in the recent journalism that you did, but I do think that's an interesting thing. I'm glad you asked that, Jamie, because now I bet a lot of people who were potentially dismissive of the points of unions. Now, no one can leave, basically, is what I'm saying. We are. I'm holding my own captive meeting right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we are the three of us, because there's power in union anyway.
Oh, right.
but you have two recent pieces, a few actually, but you have one in the New Republic and you have one at Jacobin. The New Republic one just kind of goes over the basics and it's very good. I highly recommend it. And you set up this David and Goliath situation, if I can just read this one part of it. You say it is pure David and Goliath, though maybe that doesn't fully capture it. Bezos is worth $184 billion. The median household income in Bessemer is just over $30,000. One in four residents live in poverty. This is a man who has everything trying to crush a town. Should the organizing drive succeed, the Bessemer employees will be the first Amazon workers to unionize in the U.S. A smaller effort involving a few dozen technicians in Middleton, Delaware, was defeated in 2014 with a vote of 21 no to 6 yes. Talk about the stakes of that. And then you say Amazon, out of ways to delay the election, is still running a standard anti-union campaign. What this means is holding captive audience meetings where workers are required to listen to fear-mongering by management. Those who speak up face attempts at intimidation, which Chris referred to. But can you expand on that and what workers are being subjected to?
Yeah. So Amazon does not hold back when it comes to running an anti-union campaign. Like I've said, you know, they hate unions. They have to deal with them in Europe. Some of their workers in Europe are unionized. And they, you know, at times in France at the beginning of the pandemic, they actually shut down their facilities rather than obey court rulings. That said, they had to sort of had have better working conditions. So they hate this stuff. And so in Bessemer, what they've been doing is holding captive audience meetings, which is, as Chris referred to, you know, during your shift, you're pulled into a classroom or a room where management starts giving you anti-union talking points. The Bessemer workers have said repeatedly that they're sort of scared and threatened in these meetings, that if they start speaking up to point out that they're lying to the workers, that they're either filmed or otherwise it's made clear that their identification is being taken down in an attempt to get people to stop talking. And again, these are people, these managers lie. They've always lied. I mean, that's not just true at Amazon. That's true at every company. But Amazon management has been sort of caught on record lying about unions. You know, for example, they're saying they're going to have to pay a ton of dues. First of all, it's a right to work state. You don't have to pay any dues if you don't want to. I think that's bad. I think everyone should pay dues, but just it's factually incorrect what they're telling people. But so there's that. There's, you know, workers report getting a dozen texts a day. You know, every employee is getting texts that are anti-union. Like Chris said, there's police at the facility. It's making the whole thing an incredible, even more unpleasant to work at Amazon than it already was. The thing about this mail-in voting, which is what's going on because of the pandemic, is that by law, Amazon has to stop holding these captive audience meetings once the voting starts, which it started on February 8th. So it's a particularly extended period of time that they're voting. It's, you know, almost 2 months voting process. So those meetings have stopped, but you know, the flyers in the bathroom that say don't vote for a union, the texts, all of that stuff, that's still going on. So they've been legally restrained a little bit, but they're still, you know, the workers are still being intimidated. And we really can't undercount how important that is, because for a lot of workers who might have been ambivalent, if you're subjected to this stuff day in and day out, and told that your facility is going to close or you're going to have to spend all this money, if your manager is lying to you all the time and and it's relentless, then you go from ambivalent to anti-union. And it's not because you hate unions, it's because you're scared. And so I think whatever the results are, a big part of the story is going to be that this anti-union campaign that was waged by Amazon.
And what are the kind of the most disgusting things that you've heard so far in terms of the lies, the misrepresentations? And then of course, we can ask you about your piece, which is great. It's about how you deal with this as a journalist, how they respond to you.
Yeah, I mean, Amazon just lies. That's what you're referring to is this piece I wrote, I guess, 2 days ago. I've actually written about like 10 pieces about this Amazon campaign. Yeah, Chris was leaving to speak to Sarah Nelson, and I actually did. Right. I had a long conversation with her because she visited Bessemer, which I think is great. It's good that a labor leader like that would go there to support the union campaign. But yeah, in that piece, I sort of open it by saying that everybody knows who writes about Amazon, that Amazon lies, you know, and the three of us might think that like executives at companies lie all the time. And I think we'd probably be right in thinking that, but it's like mainstream journalists know that Amazon lies. Like they right. just have a record here of small lies and big lies, you know, lies about the injury rates at their warehouses have been, you know, shown to be like radically undercounting the number of injuries. Amazon's warehouses have way higher than average injury rates, which is a thing that the company had real reason to want to lie about, but they did it. And no one would have found out if it weren't for, you know, this investigative journalist that sort of found these records. And they lie about small things. Like they'll say a local journalist said one thing when in fact, then the journalist produces an email where they say the opposite. So I think that's just an important context for people to know about Amazon, that you really can't take them at their word. So again, you know, what they've been saying to workers about the dues is a lie. Also, it's worth noting that, of course, Amazon gave hazard pay to workers towards the start of the pandemic. That was $2 an hour. And they put out lots of press releases about it. And everyone was very proud of them and celebrating how much they cared about their workers. And they quietly rolled that back and took away the $2 an hour within about 2 months' time. So by the end of, I think, May, all the workers no longer were having that hazard pay. So when they talk about the union is going to take some of your money, some Bessemer workers themselves have pointed out that, like, you know, who cares? You took our money first. There's no way we're going to, you know, lose more money than what you took away from us, even as the pandemic kept going. So it's things like that. And again, I mean, a lot of people, especially in a state like Alabama, who are young, have no experience with unions. And so if they're exposed to lie after lie, it's, you know, not surprising that they start believing it. And so these things are really insidious, I think, is a key thing to take away. They also, you know, there's been reporting that showed that they're sort of hiring workers who are temps that won't be in the union and having them wear, you know, vote no pins and otherwise like anti-union flair on the shop floor. So these are workers who, you know, are totally alienated from the rest of the workforce because they're even more temp than everyone else. Many of them, you know, it's been pointed out that there's a large, you know, prison nearby, and these are workers with records, often working in the warehouses and recruited, you know, without many options otherwise for employment. And then they're sort of subjected to the fact that they're supposed to be scabs and supposed to be wearing this anti-union flair and stuff. And so, you know, it's just like a very, I think, illustrative and rich microcosm what's going on there of what the sort of state of American labor is, which is these divisions are sort of used to even further weaken the American working class. And that's all playing out in this one facility. And so as you can imagine, I think a lot of the workers there are very exhausted and ready for this campaign to come to an end, which, you know, is scary because, you know, an exhausted and demoralized workers are not going to be workers who want to keep fighting. And Amazon has started being very strange on social media lately.
They're mad.
Something is going on. And actually, there was reporting today that came out that showed that this is actually coming from the top. It's Jeff Bezos who was saying that he wanted Amazon to be more aggressive in pushing back against sort of the claims that it's bad to work at Amazon, which is a very interesting strategy that has gone incredibly poorly for them.
Oh, yeah. Like the one about workers pissing in bottles where they were like, oh, no one would work there. No one would be willing to work here if we made them do that. But like it's already been documented by reporters and not like crazy socialist reporters, like normal ones.
Right. Normal, and I just want to say, while we have this Dave Clark tweet up.
We're going to go look at that. Yeah. Great.
So this guy is sort of the CEO of like the retail sort of side. But he played a huge role in the logistics like infrastructure that Amazon has. So he played a big role in setting up a lot of these warehouses. And actually his nickname, he has said this before in years past, he got the nickname of the sniper because he would hide in warehouses and try to catch people who were slacking to fire them. So this guy sucks. Like, he really sucks. He's not Jeff Bezos, but he is like, if anybody has responsibility for the working conditions in these warehouses, he is one of those people. And so it's very interesting that he felt sort of that he was okay to start making claims about Amazon being a good place to work, which is what this tweet did.
Yeah, let's go. Let's look at this tweet. And yeah, he said this about himself, that he acknowledged he was called the sniper.
Yes. Yeah, he has in the past. Years ago.
All right, years ago, yeah. That was, you know, remember Gordon Gekko said greed is good? It was a different time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. I don't think it was that long ago, but their PR wasn't as refined as it is now.
I mean, an interesting thing that I think a lot of people on the left don't realize, because, you know, on the left, it's understood that Amazon sucks, right? Because there have been stories for years now about how bad the working conditions in the warehouses are. So I think people like us, often we don't know a lot of people who like Amazon. Or, you know, if you use Amazon, it's sort of embarrassing or something. People are like ashamed about it. But, you know, at least a couple years ago, I think it was, there was a survey of Americans, and Amazon was one of the most trusted institutions in America. Among Democrats, I think it was number one. Among Republicans, I think it was number three after the military and like the local police or something. And so it was, you know, people love Amazon. And so this idea that it's like shameful to work for Amazon or to be responsible for this this logistics setup they have that requires that workers are timed down to the second. For a lot of people, it is not shameful. And actually everybody they know loves Amazon. And so I think, you know, if you did that survey today, it might have shifted a little bit. But we have a ways to go as far as how the average person in this country views this company.
Yeah.
How are we going to do that? Because I feel like there is an audience among a certain kind of left liberal that maybe reads the New York Times. Maybe they voted for Elizabeth Warren. Like, they at least pretend to care about these things. Like, how do we make Amazon as radioactive as big tobacco?
Well, I don't know. I think this could reach the libs you're talking about. It may not be able to. Dave Clark, the guy we were just talking about. I welcome Senator Sanders to Birmingham and appreciate his push for a progressive workplace. I often say we are the Bernie Sanders of employers, but that's not quite right because we actually deliver a progressive workplace.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
For our constituents. Oh, sorry. He also, dude, hire someone to like write your tweets out better so that they flow and they stop. You can do the plus tweets. Trust me, I just discovered this and I'm extremely online, so I get it. But because we actually deliver a progressive workplace for our constituents, colon, a $15 minimum wage, health care from day one, career progression, and a safe and inclusive work environment. So if you want to hear about a $15 an hour and health care, Senator Sanders will be speaking downtown. But if you would like to make at least $15 an hour and have good health care, Amazon is hiring.
I like how you kind of read that in a Mean Girls voice. That's the voice that it should be read in, like full on Regina George.
First of all, the $15 minimum wage thing was, there was a literally an act, right? Called like the Bezos Act.
The Stop Bezos Act.
Stop Bezos
Sanders,
Act.
Yeah. Sanders like really agitates these people.
Yeah. You,
like
really,
there's
really
a reason. There's a reason this meltdown started happening when Sanders said he was going to go to Alabama to support the union. Like, you know, you can say what you will about Sanders or whatever, but the truth is, you know, in the response from the corporations, which is they start losing it when he makes a move like this.
Yep. Also, thanks for sharing the article about it, the Business Insider article about it. Mr. Clark. It's kind of weird, but again, he's not so good on. Do you think that there must be like so many Amazon consultants who are like, get Clark away from his laptops?
Well, the interesting thing that came out today in an article that Vox published, they have a reporter who's just on the Amazon beat pretty much. And it turns out that actually the tweets that I'm sure we'll get to that were sent from Amazon News, which is the company's sort of PR arm, were seen as so outside the bounds of what's normal that the software engineers at Amazon started flagging it and assuming that maybe someone had gotten access to the account who wasn't authorized to do it. Because this was just, you know, the actual sort of team that understood how this works were like, this is so insane that these tweets are being made and posted by executives and by the company that something, maybe we got hacked or something. So yeah, totally. I think going forward, Dave Clark is being, his password is being withheld from him.
I know. And his password is probably password, honestly, if
that's
we're being
true.
Honest. Yeah. Let me just show this one other thing that, again, they're really totally shameless about this. In recent years, Amazon has advocated for increasing the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour, highlighting in the research that the current minimum wage sits at $7.25 an hour, a level unchanged since 2009, the longest stretch without an increase. And again, yes, and that is because they were forced to do that.
And can I just add something about this? Because this is like one of the things that drives me the most insane about how people talk and report on Amazon. Which is people sort of take this $15 starting wage that Amazon offers at its facilities and they compare it to like fast food starting wages. So they compare it to like McDonald's and they're like, see how much better Amazon is than McDonald's. Amazon is not a fast food job. Amazon is a warehouse and logistics job with all the physical strain and injuries and dangers and exhaustion that come with that. And it's not like a conspiracy theory. It's not unclear. The studies are very obvious and straightforward on this, that Amazon pays less than the prevailing wage in its industry. You know, other warehouses pay more. Amazon is paying less than average. And actually, when Amazon comes to town, when it builds a facility in a county, wages at other warehouses in that county go down. And so Amazon is dragging wages down. People are sort of, they take this $15 wage as if Amazon is progressive in some way. It is paying the bare minimum it needs to pay to attract workers. And so the fact that people sort of compare this to actual minimum wage jobs is just a complete misunderstanding of what this work entails. And also buying hook, line, and sinker, Amazon's own PR on this, which is they want you to compare it to those jobs. They don't want you to think of it as a logistics job, which is usually unionized and has benefits far beyond what these jobs have.
And the Stop Bezos Act, that stood for Stop Bad Employers by Zeroing Out Subsidies Act. So that's what Bernie worked on. And of course, Kana. What was it that they said that was so dishonest that it
the pissing in bottles one.
Okay.
So it was a reply to Mark Pocan, who's a representative who co-chairs the Labor Caucus in Congress. Yeah, I mean, and just to explain to your listeners, like, the representative was calling out Amazon for union busting and also mentioned that workers at Amazon pee in bottles, which is based on reporting that a British journalist, James Bloodworth, did, where he went undercover at a warehouse in the UK a few years ago and found that workers were doing that. And so that's sort of where it's famously known. But Amazon responded to Mark directly on Twitter and said, you don't really believe the pissing in bottles thing, right?
Amazon management knows its workers urinate in bottles and even defecate in bags in order to save time, internal company documents leaked to me reveal.
We have it from multiple sources. I don't remember the blog, but it was like this old guy who was actually defending working at Amazon, although, you know, maybe he was actually some other guy with an agenda, but I don't think so. And he was like, yeah, I had to relieve myself in a bottle on my delivery shift, but it's fine. I'm old. I'm lucky to have this job. Like, we have multiple sources telling us this.
Right. And now I
found you just go on Reddit to the Reddits where drivers for Amazon sort of congregate and post, like, you'll find hundreds of comments about this. It's just understood that this is part of being a delivery driver for Amazon, is that you have no access to bathrooms and also no time to find one because you're timed down to the second. And so, yes, it was very strange that Amazon sort of dared journalists to find proof of this, because you don't have to even be a journalist to find proof of this.
Right. So Mark Pocan, the representative, tweets out, paying workers $15 an hour doesn't make you a progressive workplace. When you union bust to make workers urinate in water bottles. And Amazon News tweets back, you don't really believe the peeing in bottles thing, do you? If that were true, nobody would work for us. The truth is that we have over a million incredible employees around the world who are proud of what they do and have great wages and healthcare from day one. They love saying this, from day one. And Pocan says, and yes, I do believe your workers. You don't. We hope you can enact and then Amazon News writes, we hope you can enact policies that get other employers to offer what we already do. And then Dan Price, who I want to have on the show, you killed so many small businesses that you're now the only employer in many towns. People don't quit because that would mean going hungry. True. Uh-oh. Then they go after Warren. So Warren wrote, I didn't write the loopholes you exploit, Amazon. Your armies of lawyers and lobbyists did. But you bet I'll fight to make you pay your fair share and fight your union busting and fight to break up big tech so you're not powerful enough to heckle senators with snotty tweets. Guys, this is how much I hate Amazon. They're making me like Elizabeth Warren. So,
I know. I was about to say.
I know. And yet she persisted. This is extraordinary and revealing. One of the most powerful politicians in the United States just said she's going to break up an Amazon company so that they can't criticize her anymore. They're good. I feel like, I mean, they're almost good.
They're trying to do like that sassy Twitter clapback thing.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work when you're punching down like that.
Which you always are.
Which Amazon,
just 'cause you're
Amazon. Yeah, Amazon right. is never not punching down.
Right.
Right. It's like Darth Vader cannot do a clapback. Like, that doesn't make any
sense. Right, exactly. Yeah.
And they're trying to make it look like they're punching up by calling her one of the most powerful politicians in the United States. But spoiler alert, she's not.
Also, the thing that Warren references here about the lobbyists, it's like Amazon has, I think they recently, as in like maybe 4 days ago, got surpassed by Facebook, but they had the most lobbyists of any company in the country. So we're talking about armies of lobbyists. Robert Reich, former labor secretary, recently was testifying about Amazon and described, I think, platoons of lobbyists, which I think is a correct way to describe it. I mean, this company owns the country. The more you sort of know about how this company works at the county level, about how decisions are made and how tax subsidies are granted, it's like politicians serve at the behest of Amazon here. So, I mean, Warren is completely correct that like they are writing these laws and they're in charge of, you know, what does and doesn't happen. So it just makes no sense for Amazon to accuse anyone of being more powerful than them. It's just simply not accurate anymore.
Yeah.
Maybe 20 years ago, they were just a book company, but that is just like way out of
date. I forgot that. Yeah, I forgot that. Yeah. If you have another question, Jamie, ask another question. Then I just wanted you to give a quick summary of the PRO Act, if you don't mind.
Sure. Yeah, let's go to the PRO Act. Let's talk about it. I think it's important.
Yeah. Okay.
So the PRO Act is a sweeping labor law reform that has been passed in the House of Representatives by a vote of, I think, like 225 to, you know, it passed in the House. I think everybody except one Democrat voted for it. And I think every Republican voted against it except for five people. I think five Republicans favored it. So now it's in the Senate. What it does is, so there have been several efforts to reform labor law. Labor law as it exists in this country is incredibly stacked in favor of the employer at every level. I mean, it's just like shocking when you first start paying attention to this stuff. It's like, how does a worker ever win a union in this country? It's really a miracle every single time that someone wins. And that's because, you know, everything in this regime is stacked against workers. So this is a very ambitious labor law, which does distinguish it from past ones such as EFCA, the Employee Free Choice Act, which was sort of labor's big push when Obama got elected, which was less ambitious. It sort of addressed one problem within the sort of broad set of things that stop workers from getting unions and winning contracts. And Obama didn't do anything to try to get it passed, even though he'd promised labor he would. And this is exactly how it always works with Democrats. Labor relies on them. They get out the vote. They do incredible mobilization to elect Democrats to, you know, positions, and then they turn their back on labor and don't push for their priorities. So labor, to its credit this time around, has said, you know, we might as well go for everything. We might as well have this sweeping, incredibly ambitious thing if we're only going to get, you know, a sort of Hail Mary shot. And so the PRO Act, you know, addresses all sorts of things. I won't bore your listeners with the details of it. I've done like several interviews about this that you could link to if you'd like with labor lawyers and experts and union members and whatnot. But it basically, the point here of the act is that it makes it easier for workers to organize unions. It makes it easier for them to get first contracts, and it makes it easier for them to strike and otherwise take action on the job. It increases penalties to employers for violating the law. It gives teeth to the National Labor Relations Board to fine employers more for violating workers' rights, so on and so forth. So that's what the PRO Act is. You know, it's a bit of a chicken and egg problem with labor law reform in this country, in that, you know, unions are so weak that politicians, you know, often don't have real reason to have to listen to them. And yet it's hard to get unions and workers stronger without reforming the laws. I mean, we're seeing it play out at the Amazon campaign right now, just how much the laws are stacked against unions. And so that's what this law is. I'm sure there's, you know, people might want to debate the odds it has of getting passed, but that's what it is.
Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. See you next time. You can find Alex Press on Twitter at Alex N Press. You can find Chris Smalls on Twitter at shut_down Amazon. And you can find Jamie Peck on Twitter at Jamie_Elizabeth. The Katie Halper Show is produced by Nick Palm. Our intern is Maria Trujillo. Our theme song is by the band Cordova. This episode of The Katie Halper Show was edited by Ted Reedy.
If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.